This is a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the US-China Trade War Podcast with me, Finbart Birmingham, on the political economy desk here at the South China Morning Post. It is the last day of July and we've had 6 months of coronavirus here in Hong Kong. We now find ourselves knee-deep in the third wave, pretty stringent social distancing measures enacted and rising caseload every day. I've got a new mic, so things may sound a little bit differently than they usually do, but we're working on that. We're coming to you from our respective home studios dotted across Hong Kong, Tin Hau, Wan Chai, Happy Valley, and so on. I'll be joined, as ever, by our erudite editors on the desk, John Carter and Joe Sin. No huge explosions this week in the US-China dynamic, but then again, it is only Friday. But lots to discuss nonetheless, as the two trade war economies track very differently in their performances following the pandemic. Meanwhile, Chinese leader Xi Jinping has been getting out some strong messaging to let us know that China is preparing for decoupling, more on that anon. Then in the second part of the show, I'll be joined by Amina Mohammed, the Kenyan candidate to be the Director General at the World Trade Organization. Minister Mohammed is considered by many to be the frontrunner for this role. She has decades of experience at the WTO and in the Kenyan government. She's an impressive female leader from an African nation at a point when many feel that the WTO needs to be more diverse in its leadership. I'm delighted that she joined me on a video call from her base in Geneva, where she's campaigning against seven other candidates. She gave us her views on how the WTO can go from talking shop to mediator in the US-China trade dispute. This is the second of our interviews with the candidates. If you missed it, I would encourage you to go back and check out our chat with the Mexican candidate Jesus Seade from a couple of months back. We'll bring you more of these over the coming weeks. Enjoy the show. Delighted to be joined today by John Carter and Joe Sin, our political economy editors here at the South China Morning Post. We are again recording in exile as Hong Kong's third wave of coronavirus infections continues. It's been a relatively quiet week in terms of the US-China relationship. There's a lot going on, but there are no major events that we've seen upending things, at least not so far this week. But it gives us some time to take stock on how the two different economies are dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. This morning, we've had some data from China. Last night, which was Thursday, we had some data from the United States. And John Carter, they seem to show two trade war economies which are going really in the opposite direction.
Indeed. The PMI this morning, which is a sentiment indicator of sentiment in the manufacturing, services, and construction sectors, improved again in July, showing that the Chinese recovery is on track, at least in the first month of the third quarter. This is in sharp contrast with U.S. GDP data, which showed a 32.9% decline in U.S. GDP in the second quarter. Now, the U.S. went into the coronavirus outbreak a quarter later than did China. So China's out first, its economy is doing better. But the U.S. is at risk of falling back into an even deeper economic problem. The unemployment insurance claims of people who are trying to get money from the government because they're unemployed, the numbers rose yesterday in the latest week, which was a surprise and an indication of how badly the U.S. is doing, given the very sharp increase in coronavirus cases in recent weeks. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell warned about this in his comments in the middle of the week, saying that the U.S. economy is at risk of losing its momentum if something isn't done to arrest these coronavirus cases. He also urged the U.S. Congress to pass its new stimulus bill as quickly as possible. But Democrats and Republicans are fighting over it, and it doesn't look like there's going to be an early resolution of this, all of which is bad for the U.S. economy. This in turn raises questions about the demand for Chinese exports, so there could be a knock-on effect on the Chinese economy.
Absolutely, and something I saw just before we started recording is that 32.9% contraction in the U.S. economy is the equivalent of 5 years' growth over one quarter. So, I mean, when you think about it in that
sense, it's absolutely cataclysmic. The Chinese economy contracted by 6.8%, at least officially, in the first quarter. It never got to the depths that the US economy did. We're expecting to see Eurozone economic data later today, John, and that's not going to be a pretty picture either, I don't think.
No, it's the Europeans, maybe not quite as bad as the U.S., but it will be bad. Like the U.S., they entered the coronavirus outbreak later, and so their economy in the second quarter is going to look worse. Having said that, it's difficult to compare the numbers. The Chinese numbers are year over year, whereas the U.S. numbers are annualized. Basically, you take the quarterly rate and multiply by four. But your assumption is correct that the U.S. did worse in the second quarter than China did in the first, and that is important to note.
Jiaxin, there are challenges, of course, facing the Chinese economy. It's not out of the woods yet. We've had some infections this week again pop up around the country. There are 2 million citizens displaced along the Yangtze River as the flooding nationwide across 27 provinces continues. Is there a sense within your interpretation of what's coming out of Beijing that they understand the fragility of this recovery and that it's not a given that this will continue?
I think from the political meeting yesterday, for the immediate economic prospects, I think the Chinese government is quite confident because they, as John just said, you know, they look around the world and China is certainly, you know, performing among the best. The second quarter growth was 3.2, kind of sharp reversal from rebound from the 6.8 contraction in the first quarter. And also, more importantly, it seems that despite of these disruptions, the floods and also outbreak in Xinjiang and in the northeast, it seems the economy is still doing very well, as PMI this morning showed. So for the immediate prospects, for the next 6 to 12 months, China is quite confident that it can be, among the best in the world. So there's, if you look at the policy outlines, it's actually quite hawkish, which means the central bank will not pump money into the economy as strong as expected, which means the Beijing is want more targeted flow of capitals into certain sectors to want to help instead of an all-out stimulus. So that's the situation in China. I think the most pressing issue or the biggest worry for the Chinese government is over the long term. It's relationship with the United States, and that's quite clear from yesterday's meeting as well. Because for this kind of Politburo meeting, it's always happened at the end of July, and usually it's just to look at the next 6 to 12 months. But yesterday was quite different. It not only looks the next 5 years, but even, you know, goes beyond to 2035. And you can see like how Beijing is bracing for the turbulence going ahead. And the biggest takeaway by the market is that, you know, China has to do this domestic, called great domestic circulation. In plain words, which basically means we have to cut reliance of the global market. We have to rely more on ourselves. It's basically an inward-looking policy in response to a hostile environment.
Jiaxin, just to tell us a little bit about these Politburo meetings. How often do they happen? Are they usually quite significant? What sort of things typically are you as a journalist looking out for in these meetings? Because obviously it's not as transparent maybe as you would have in other capitals. How does a journalist read these sorts of things?
Yes. The Politburo statement is a typical so-called tea leaf reading, right? Yeah, because you never know what's going on behind the doors. You never know who punched the table or who yelled back. These kind of things are always not available for the outside world. What you can have is just a heavily polished, heavily edited statement from Xinhua. And what it can do is to compare it with previous documents. To see the changes in the rhetoric, in the wording, and then you can see some changes in the thinking in the Chinese leadership. For the Politburo meeting, for the economies, usually it's now happening on a quarterly basis. And the most important one, of course, is the annual one. And now it's a middle year one. But this one is particularly important because what we have seen in the last 3 months, you know, during the crisis period, a few weeks' time can be like a few decades in normal times, right? So this is what Beijing has been construing. I mean, the statements, of course, did not name Donald Trump or did not mention the United States, but it's the elephant in the room, and everyone is knowing what she is referring to when he says no country or person can stop China's great rejuvenation. And certainly he is pointing fingers at the United States. You know, he tried to contain my rise, but you know, you will not get what you want.
Strong and consistent messaging coming out of China over recent weeks. John, with regard to PMI that we saw from Beijing this morning, interestingly, I saw that the construction sector seems to be doing extraordinarily well. Is this a sign that China is relying on the old playbook of construction, building, property, real estate and infrastructure to, in a way, build its way out of the coronavirus pandemic crisis?
Yes, but perhaps not as much as it did after the global financial crisis back in 2008-2009. But it's clear that the construction sector is one of the leading lights in the Chinese economy at the moment. As you noted, the PMI, again, which is a sentiment index, the sentiment for the construction sector is over 60, which is huge. It means the construction sector is booming. And a lot of this is being fed by government stimulus money to build the infrastructure projects at the local level. And I would note that we've written a number of stories on this, but this has led to a boom in iron ore and coal imports from Australia to feed this construction boom, not only in infrastructure, but also in the property market. And the statements from the big Australian mining companies said, the sharp increase in demand from China is offsetting weak demand from the rest of the world. And they pointed out that they didn't see much in the way of demand from the U.S., from Europe, from Japan, from Korea that they had seen before. The only country on its feet is China, and they expected this to continue in the period ahead.
Zhou Xian, you mentioned the Politburo meeting, which took place on Thursday evening in Beijing. We also had it's been quite a vocal week for the Chinese leadership because Xi Jinping was in the province of Jilin last week, and he had some more things to say along the same lines. What can we read about the U.S.-China relationship, about China's view of decoupling and so on, from these public statements, which don't come as frequently as they do with other leaders, from Xi Jinping?
Yes, Dumba. The trip to Jilin is very interesting because he was looking at, you know, Jilin is a big agriculture province in China, and she particularly mentioned food supply security, which means China is preparing for a quite like bad environment. You know, as long as there are enough food, enough grain output domestically, you know, China, possibly the Chinese governments don't have to worry too much about social unrest. But as long as the message is very clear that China has to rely on itself, China has to grow its home market, there are many, many arguments or debates about how China can do this. You know, it's easy to say, but it's very difficult to do. Because as John just mentioned, you know, China's economic recovery is imbalanced. It's led by the construction. And who did the construction? It's the state-owned companies, it's the local government, and the financial vehicles controlled by local governments. That's a huge problem for the Chinese economy. You know, the China has been, you know, Chinese miracle for the last 4 decades. But, you know, Japan, when Japan has like 30 years of development after the Second World War, it created basically, it caught 100 million middle class, right? But China is a completely polarized society. On the one hand, we see, you know, the premier is saying like 600 million people still have a monthly income of 1,000 yuan, which is less than 150 US dollars a month. That's like hardest to believe even for most like economists looking at China. You know, what are you talking about? Even a baijiu, a bottle of Maotai cost more than that. and why was that happening? And that's because of the national wealth distribution is extremely unfair for the, you know, it's tilting towards, first of all, towards the state. And then it's even for the people part is still tilting towards those have instead of those have nots. So that's a huge problem, and that's require lots of structural reforms to happen before China creating a sustainable domestic market. And that's also, people are doubting, you know, whether China can really do this. By doing this, which means, you know, the state basically has to step back from the economy. Because if you look at, you know, last month we reported one Pu County spending, accumulated basically 40 billion yuan debts, which is 10 times of its annual fiscal revenues. And this is a vivid example of how this money has been wasted. Instead of going to the household, you know, people tend to spend more wisely. You just have a big ticket projects. And this is exactly the problem. For Baijiu, for the Maotai, there's a famous saying in China that those people who buy the Maotai don't drink it. Those people who drink the Maotai never have to worry buying about it. That's the situation in the Chinese economy. So there's lots of things going on. And it's quite interesting to see how Xi Jinping is going to change that, you know, this kind of decades of strategy that really, you know, never really took off.
Very great analysis there, Joshin. Lovely references to the delicious Chinese liquor there. Guys, throw it forward. What are we going to see, both in terms of the economy and geopolitics over the coming week? What are we looking out for?
Key data next week will be trade data next Friday. We will see if Chinese exports are holding up. As we reported yesterday, the U.S. imports of personal protection equipment had fallen sharply in July, and almost all of those come from China. And now PPE, as it's called, has been the fastest growing export category for China and has held up exports in the second quarter. If exports to the U.S. are falling sharply, that could put downward pressure on Chinese exports in July, and that could be bad for the overall economy, but we'll see. We're also going to look at imports, given what I told you about iron ore, it looks like, and coal. It looks like China stepped up their imports of those in order to supply their construction boom. So we'll see what that implies for the overall economy.
Great, John. And Joshin, anything on the political side that you're keeping your eye on?
For the summer, usually, you know, China has this famous Beidai He meeting, you know, all the Chinese leadership just going to the beaches in Hebei province. But there's a big speculation of will this happen this year because of the coronavirus? And if it doesn't happen, what kind of impact will it have for the decision-making process? Because yesterday's Politburo meeting said they will have an even bigger Communist Party gathering in October. And this will be very important, because this will talk about China's five-year planning specifics and will decide lots of important positions. And so if this Beidai He meeting is not happening, which means that a big consultation part is missing from this year, which also can show that China is speeding up the process of preparing for a kind of decoupling and rivalry against the United States. As today, as this morning, we can already see some ministers has been renamed, you know, the Shaanxi provincial governor, a party secretary has been changed. So we can see that there are something going on in Beijing. You know, they are starting from the personnel, starting from the strategy, they are preparing for this.
Something's in the works indeed. We'll find out more about whether the CCP is going to the beach over the coming weeks. For today, John Carter, Joshin, thank you so much for your insights.
We've got some big news coming to you about the South China Morning Post. Starting in August, we're bringing in a brand new digital subscription service. You'll still get unlimited access to our new and archived podcasts. But we're going to ask you to sign up for a subscription to access SCMP.com and the SCMP mobile app. It's going to work like this. You'll be able to read several stories each month for free. And after that, you'll need to be a subscriber to access more. You'll be helping to support SCMP's award-winning news reporting, in-depth analysis, and investigative journalism that lead the global conversation on China. We're introducing this in stages to our different audiences around the world, but you'll read all about it first at our website, scmp.com.
We're now going to bring you an edited audio version of the interview that I did with Minister Amina Mohammed the other day. She joined us on a video call from Geneva, where she's campaigning to be the next Director General of the World Trade Organization. We were delighted to have her as a guest on the podcast. We look forward to bringing you more of these candidates over the coming weeks. Enjoy the interview.
Congratulations on your candidacy. It seems like you're a very strong candidate. When I speak to people in the trade community, very impressed, and speak of you as certainly one of the favourites in the race. And I'd like to initially ask you about the one of the real major issues that's going to be first in the inbox, which will be the superpower rivalry, the US-China tensions. Obviously, the WTO has been slightly marginalised over the past few years, and it has been, in a sense, watching this dispute unfold from the sidelines. As Director General, would you propose to thrust the WTO into this dispute to try and play an active role in resolving it? And in what way can the WTO do that?
Well, thank you very much. Look, it's not even about thrusting the WTO into the mix. The WTO is part of the issues that needs to be addressed in order to sort out the tensions that are related to trade and to the mismatch between rights and obligations. So it's very, very important that trade issues are actually resolved within the WTO. Because it's about the rules of the WTO, the rules it's claimed have been lax. Some do not exist, so we need to strengthen the ones that are weak and can be circumvented easily. And we need to start rulemaking again for those that have no rules in new areas. So it's not as if WTO is an outsider. These issues need to be resolved within the WTO. That's where we have the rules for multilateral trade, and that's where any disputes that arise out of trade, any tensions that come out of trade, should be resolved. As Director General, absolutely, and as Director General, I think the role is to encourage parties to sit at the table and resolve these issues at the WTO, provide the facilitation, provide the space, create the environment, and make the WTO fit for purpose, an organization that can actually tackle issues head on by making sure that members can actually sit down and have candid discussions. The US and China are big players on the multilateral trading scene. And they both should be at the table at the WTO. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. I know from my own experience, long years of trade, that we need to create an environment for the US and China to resolve the issues. Issues like this have been resolved before. It's not as if we haven't had trade tensions before. I recall being in Geneva and there being huge trade tensions and the WTO creating the space, inviting the players to come and have candid discussions and very candid discussions. I think if you go back, just a few, maybe 10 years, 15 years, you'll see that there were big tensions between the other major players at that time, and that they were resolved at the WTO. So I think the WTO must regain its centrality in global economic governance.
So what's gone wrong there? Why is the WTO not central to this? It seems as though the current Director General has not taken this approach of being central to it, and he hasn't, and the WTO hasn't been able to bring the US and China to the table in Geneva.
It's not about the Director General. It's not about that. I think it's about, like I said, the rule book not having been updated for too long, needing urgent, upgrading. So basically, what we're talking about is making sure that members are sitting around the table and negotiating and addressing, the gaps that exist. You look, some of these rules that we're talking about were negotiated in 1995. The world has surely moved on since 1995. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So those rules have gaps, obviously, and those gaps are almost natural gaps because of the dynamism in trade relations today. And in the way that the multilateral trading system is functioning. And we need to fill those gaps. You cannot fill them from the outside. You must sit at the table and negotiate. So I mean, it's like you having a equipment that you bought in 1995. Yeah. If not the hardware, at least the software needs constant upgrading. You know, the rules. Yes, absolutely. I think that the international economic environment has shifted, and it has shifted in many, many ways.
Yeah.
And so we need to create the rules to address those situations.
Yeah, I mean, in these rules, if we can speak specifically, the United States, Japan, and the European Union in January floated a tightening of industrial subsidies. Would this be an example of some of the areas that you think could be addressed and should be addressed at the WTO?
I think that we need to address all the issues, right? We need to address agricultural subsidies in the same way that we need to address industrial subsidies. I have heard about the paper. It hasn't been tabled for discussions, and I think that it should be tabled because that's a way forward. We at least will have something on the table, right, to start a discussion around. So it's really important that if there are proposals that they be on the table. You know that in dispute settlement, the worker proposal is on the table. We've had a chance to actually look at it. We know that it's a good foundation for resolving some of the issues that we're facing. You know that there's a Norwegian proposal on special and differential treatment, and that too is something that we know about, and it's also a foundation for discussions. At least it's a non paper that can be put to members to discuss. The EU-Japan-US proposal needs to be on the table so that everybody can look at the proposals that are being made. I think it's excellent that members are putting proposals forward. It actually means that they're looking for a way of solving the problems that we have, the challenges that the WTO has. And so we just need to discuss them.
Sure. Can I ask you again, just one more about this trade dispute, the United States and China. What inclination have you been given that these parties are willing to negotiate at the WTO? Ambassador Lighthizer, President Trump have been very forceful in their rhetoric on the WTO, particularly in the last couple of weeks and months. On the Chinese side, there has been less rhetoric, but are you getting signals from those governments that they are willing to come to negotiate in Geneva?
When I get the job, I'll get the signals. When I get the job, I will look for the signals. I will search, with a spotlight for the signals and try and pull threads together. At the moment, I'm looking for the job, and I don't think that any member would give you signals when you're looking for the job. They'll just find out what you think about some of the issues. And I think that there are concerns that must be addressed.
Yeah. And do you get a sense that you would have a strategy for this? Because I'm sure that the current Director General has also suggested to Washington and Beijing to come to Geneva too.
Absolutely. I think everybody tries. And I'm hoping, sometimes it's about timing. Sometimes it's about putting proposals on the table that appeal. There are many reasons why things fail at different times and succeed at others. And this is not the first time that something like that would happen. We negotiated export subsidies for 15 years. We got it resolved in Nairobi. We had the IT, expanded ITA too. Wasn't going to be successful, was successful in Nairobi. We created the political will and we created the momentum that was required. We provided space for members to have to negotiate, right? And they knew that they needed to give a signal of relevance of the organization to the international community. They rose to the occasion and they did that. If you look at the trade terrain, you will see lots of successes and you'll see some failures, but timing is I think is everything. The willingness to negotiate is another one. Just getting the political will to start moving forward is the other. And noticing signals that countries are actually, members are actually ready to sit down and are looking for an honest broker who has absolutely no interest except interest in making sure that the multilateral trading system actually functions, that it functions effectively, and that it's relevant to global economic governance, then things start to happen.
Do you see that appetite existing for an honest broker, given the thrust towards protectionism, the very loud chatter about deglobalization, which I'm sure will be, you'll be asked about time and time again as well, but is that role of an honest broker desired?
TRED has been a force for good. TRED has been a partner in the alleviation of poverty. TRED has been transformational. All members of the WTO and others too who are not members have benefited from TRED. I don't think that today is the time to throw in the towel. It is not. It's time now to roll up sleeves and get to work. Update the rule book, deal with the issues around dispute settlement, right? And come up with the new areas for negotiations. I think that this is not the time to start, talking down TRED. It's time to talk up TRED. We need TRED to even come out of this pandemic faster. We don't need to talk down TRED. We don't need markets closed. We need markets open. We need goods and services flowing. And you know, it's the role of the WTO to remind members, right, and to monitor measures that are put in place that may restrict TRED and remind members that they signed on to commitments. And you don't sign on to commitments and throw them away. You sign on to them knowing that you must implement them, right? So look, I'm not one of those who's talking about, deglobalization and all that. I want to support the multilateral trading system. It was created for a purpose. It has served us well. It's facing hiccups now, and all of us must rise up and protect this system and strengthen the system.
What do you think about this? The feeling I get in the trade community that I know that the green room process was perhaps quietly dismissed over the course of the last few years, whereby multiple parties would try and thrust out agreements on a smaller level before bringing them to the wider WTO group. Is that a mechanism you would look to review or look to revive as a way of progressing from this sort of stalemate that the WTO finds itself in?
I think we should use all the tools that we have in our arsenal to support the multilateral trading system. We must use everything that we have to bring people to the table. The two things that we cannot do is sacrifice inclusivity or compromise transparency. That we cannot do. But we must make sure that, there's so many tools in the arsenal that can be, can be used. And having a small group of countries meeting to iron out issues, is something that WTO has done for the longest time. It has produced results without, again, compromising inclusivity and transparency. We have moved between rooms. And you'd have three rooms in a row. One would be, whatever one calls it, green, blue, yellow. And there would be others that would hold other delegations and would be moving between these rooms to get issues resolved. And we did get them resolved, including leading an amendment to a major agreement, the TRIPS agreement, that I did.
Yeah.
And it's possible to use different formations to get a result. I believe that to be true for the WTO, as it is for many other organizations, that you can get a few members in a room, have a discussion, and then go out and discuss it with the rest of the membership. Invite those that have proposals to talk to the rest of the membership in different formations, whether they're coming to talk to the African group or to the group of least developed countries or to the European group, but encourage members to engage with each other. I mean, that's what it's about. At the end of the day, these rules must apply across the board.
Sure. When I speak with academics and advisors in China, Minister Mohammed, there is a sense that an African candidate may be favored in China, although I know that the government in Beijing is keeping its counsel and playing its cards very close to its chest. What's been your dealings with Chinese officials in Geneva? Have you had many dealings with them? Do you get a sense that there's an appetite for an African candidate from Beijing?
Look, as I was ambassador in Geneva, And I was Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Trade. And I dealt with all members of the WTO. I dealt with them on different issues, on all issues that were on the table. I chaired a ministerial meeting in Nairobi where everybody was present. I have attended different mini-ministerials across the world. I've attended the mini-ministerials at Davos almost every year except this one. So we talk to all countries. We talk to all members. And as a candidate, you ask for support from everybody. And I'm going to be doing that. I've started and I'll continue doing that. I hope that I get selected by members. I think that the membership has 8 candidates on the table, and it's just about who fits the bill for doing this job right now. And you need the support of all, if not most of the members. To get selected, you know, the selection process is a very long one.
Yeah,
so, yes, I'm asking for support from everyone.
But can you say specifically about your dealings with Beijing?
I've dealt with them at a bilateral level, like as I've dealt with all other countries when I was Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Trade. I dealt with everybody else. I dealt with the EU on many issues at that time. I dealt with the US on many, many issues, including organizing, visits to the US of our high officials. So you deal with everybody. I don't think that one should ever shrink their marketplace. I think that you should get support from all members, and you deal with all members. I don't have any particular issues with any of the members. I think that I have done a good job in Geneva. I did a great job at the ministerial in Nairobi, and so I hope that all countries will judge me by not just my track record, but my vision for the organization, what it is that I bring to the table. I have, when you experience processes, you actually can notice what's missing. You know where the gaps are. If you've never experienced these processes, you won't be able to find them even with a spotlight. So you need to have experienced the systems to know the players, to know the mechanisms and the tools that you have in your hand to sort out issues. If you don't, you can't send a doctor to go and fix a car. So I think that it's important that and that's an issue that has been raised by others. It's important that one has expertise, experience, that one has the political skills to get things done. But absolutely, and I think it's fundamental that you know what the issues are. If you don't know what the issues are, even with the best, and we've seen that at the WTO, even with the best political skills that have been tested, it will not work. If you know how the system functions, if you understand how the members feel about the WTO, how they work within the WTO, how the secretariat facilitates the work of the WTO, then it's easier to use your political skills to get things done. And I'm hoping that if I get the opportunity, that then I can use, I can use my experience, I can bring my vision to life and my commitment to reforming the organization to make it fit for purpose. I know what it was like before. I know what it can be.
And what's the biggest item, number one, on the agenda if and when you do take office?
I think, first of all, we need to deal with the issue, the shortcomings of the WTO. This negotiating function has stalled. Members are not really negotiating as they used to. I mean, the only multilateral negotiation right now is the fisheries one, which we hope will end in December, which is, the UN deadline for fisheries to be concluded. And the others are plurilaterals. All right. The others are plurilaterals. The WTO was actually established to be a multilateral forum for negotiations. So I think restarting that multilateral negotiation, reigniting that light, I think would be a really key thing to do. It makes members comfortable with each other. It rebuilds trust because there's a real deficit. Confidence in the system. The dispute settlement mechanism, that needs to be addressed because it gives predictability.
Thanks for listening to this week's US-China Trade War podcast. I've been Finbar Birmingham on the political economy desk here at the SCMP. Don't forget to keep up with all the news on the trade war, on the coronavirus, on the WTO race at scmp.com. You can follow our team on Twitter at SCMP Economy. I'm at F Birmingham. That's Birmingham with a B-E-R, not like this city. We'll see you back here next week. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and please wear a mask. Have a good week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.